welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Hello, Rob Greaves here, and welcome to another program in the award-winning series of Listen to Older Voices. This is part two of a three-part program on the life and times of 57-year-old Robin Yolton. Born into a caring and loving family, Robin got the benefits of that love and care and the benefits of life in post-war Australia. A smart girl, she enjoyed school, although because she was so advanced for her age, she suffered greatly from the taunts of other children. She left school and worked in a bank, but it was the 60s and life in society was changing rapidly. And Robin was part of those changing times. She discovers that she has an excellent voice and sings on Young Talent Time. She also had the great Evie Hayes as a manager, and she scored a great gig at Jeff Brooks' Steak Cave for 5 nights a week. She also starts an all-female rock band, The Screaming Heap. But in the 70s, the bottom drops out of the music business, and she finds she needs to return to study, attending La Trobe University. We learn so much about her, including her work in animal welfare. But now, we pick up with Robin talking about the earlier stages of a musical career.
I ended up with a manager called Evie Hayes.
Yes, very well known.
Yes, well, she was my manager. She right. decided she liked my singing, and she put me into a job 5 nights a week singing at a place called Jeff Brooks Steak Cave, which was the place to be.
Yes.
And I've never seen so much money in all my life.
Well, what style were you singing then?
At that stage, it was, I suppose you'd call it folk, mm-hmm. like Bob Dylan, you know, Leonard
Joni
Cohen.
Mitchell.
Joni Mitchell. Mm. You know, all the protest songs
and
things.
Yes, yes. Yeah, well, it was big, yes. big seller those days. Yes,
but,
that's
but
right.
But my saving grace was that I originally was hired as a folk singer, but I also had a huge catalogue in my memory of all the songs I'd heard when I was growing up. I could slip into Oh, It Had to Be You, and I could work with the band who would come on during my breaks. And there was a three-piece jazz band there. So we'd do jazz songs. Mm. And then I learnt to sing My Way, which was the showstopper at the end of the night. Mm. So the boss, Mr. Brooke, kept me on for 2.5 years.
Wow, that was a good gig.
And the only thing that stopped it from going even longer was just the economy, and the bottom fell out of the restaurant industry at that time.
Because we're talking about early 70s now, aren't we? Yes, there was a big dip. Yep. Yes, that's right.
Yep. So then I had it in my mind when things were easing off a bit at the Steak Cave, and I could see it coming because the clientele, you know, you'd be lucky to get maybe 50 people for dinner where it used to be 300. Mm. And all the private rooms would be booked out as well. So I thought, no, this is going a bit sour. So, and I had done other TV appearances as well.
Some, can you give us some examples?
The Annie Sigley Show, the Don Lane Show, and I delved a bit in acting. Evie Hayes said, you know, you have to have more than one iron in the fire. So she sent me off to Crawford Productions. So I did some acting there with some great tutors. Natalie Rain and Byron Williams were my teachers, and got a few parts in Homicide and Division 4 and different things like that. So there was still the wildness in me wanting to get out and leap out of the folk singer's dress.
Burst forth.
Forth like a blooming rose. So I decided to form an all-female rock band, much to my father's chagrin.
Yes, I think you found the boundary at last, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Yes, yep.
He threw his hands up in the air. Mum just shook her head. She said, oh, no, that beautiful voice, you're going to ruin it with all that screeching.
Mind you, they're getting on in age now, aren't they?
Well, so it's getting probably my age.
Yes. I'm saying here. Right. We don't think of ourselves like our parents, though. That's
well,
the weird 60s, thing.
So what were they?
Yeah. 50s. Yeah. Well, we're talking early 70s, aren't we now?
Well, 70s. So they're in their 50s. Yeah. They're born in 1920.
But it would have been getting hard for them to relate, though.
I thought they were old.
Well, so did I at that stage.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody calls me, I'll...
Yeah, I don't... Yeah. Well, someone told me I had a senior's phone. I was upset. Just because it's got a big button.
I know.
It's shocking discrimination.
I know. But, yes. Forgive us parents, we didn't know what we meant. No, we didn't.
But the female rock band thing, I put an ad in The Age, and oh, I've got all sorts of people ringing up. There were all these women out there wanting to play guitar.
Yeah, wanting was the interesting yes. choice of words, yes.
So, and they all were potential Susie Quattros, but, you know, it was a long process before we got the band together. And we got so much work.
What was the band called?
Screaming Heap. With two E's, Screaming, yes. two E's, Heap.
Yes, Screaming H-W-P.
Heap. Yeah. We only did covers. The thought of writing your own material was unheard of. You just didn't. You just did covers. So we got so much work because we were a novelty. People would pay just to come and see what we did.
Yes.
And we were very good at what we did. And then, you know, band is like being married. You know, eventually the drummer and the bass player don't like the guitarist and the singer. It always happens.
Yes.
In those groups. I don't know why. So that band split up, and then I was in limbo between, well, I'm not doing the solo singing anymore because the restaurants are all, and there was disco then, had blown the band live
music, yes, yeah, apart, yes.
Sky high. Live bands were becoming just obsolete. You just couldn't get a gig anywhere. So I thought, well, what will I do? So I went back to school.
Oh, interesting choice. Roughly how old were you now?
I was about 25.
Okay.
So I'd been out of school for about 7 years, 8 years.
Right.
And doing music and acting, you know, pretty much full time.
Yes.
So I went and got mature age entry at La Trobe University and threw myself in full-time study to get my Bachelor of Arts. And I did that, and then that wasn't enough, so I wanted to do honours, so I did that, and that wasn't enough, so I wanted a Bachelor of Education, and that wasn't enough, so, but in between times, there's still that tugging back to music, you know, I'd do a few shows solo and think, oh, I'll defer uni, until eventually the scheme that was brought in by Gough Whitlam, where you pay a $100 service fee because he believed everyone should have the opportunity yes. to be educated. Yeah. Well, he got the flick. And then the government that was in at the time when I was in brought in the HECS scheme.
Oh, yes. A wonderful, wonderful thing. Yes. Bless them.
Well, a lot of students like myself from, you know, not very rich backgrounds couldn't afford to...
Just push people out of education.
It did.
Yeah.
It did. And I was one of them.
Yes.
Oh, they said, oh, you can pay it back when you finish your degree. And I thought, well, what if I don't get a job?
Yes.
And what if I need my full pay?
Yes.
So I thought, no, I'm not doing this. I'll wait till I've got some money. So I didn't do the Master of Arts, but I can always go back and do it.
Sure. Did you enjoy life at university as a mature age student?
Not at first. It was very lonely because the first year, I remember going into the English lecture and it was absolutely packed. But they were all 16 and 17-year-olds straight out of school.
Yeah.
And here I felt really old, at yes. 25, yes. you know. But I had a bit of worldliness about me. I'd been out in the world. I'd been out working and had a wage and I'd moved away from home. During that time too, and had a relationship. So, you know, driven a car and all sorts of things.
You're a lot more worldly.
Yeah.
Yeah, finding it hard to relate to those kids.
Well, they weren't taking it seriously at all.
Yes.
And, you know, it was like, oh, it's just the next step from year 12. They weren't turning up for lectures, and by the second semester, that number of 300 had been cut to 150. Yep. And by the end of the year, there were about 100, maybe 80, in the lecture room. So the first year dropouts was just incredible.
Yes.
And where they went and what they did, I don't know. But then the serious students stayed for the 3 years to do their degree. The numbers on the ground really thinned. So I thought, well, I'll put that on hold. So I was then living in Warrandyte. We had a beautiful cottage on 5 acres.
We?
I was in a relationship.
Right.
Yeah. And we had this beautiful little cottage with our pets and everything like that. Our backyard, the gate went straight into the state forest.
Oh, nice.
So it was lovely. But I had then gone on to the dole, and I didn't like being on the dole because my worst enemy is boredom. So sitting there with all this knowledge in my head, my degree and
singing. And a fair bit of experience.
Yeah. Yes. I'm thinking, what will I do? I don't know. Anyway, across the back from me was a boarding kennel, because I used to hear the dogs barking in the morning. So I walked around there one day and said to the woman, I'd like to put my name down if there's a job. I just live over the back fence. She said, we can start now because one of the girls hasn't turned up. So I did my, what I would call an apprenticeship in the boarding kennels, and moved from there on to become a worker at the Victorian Animal Aid Trust, which is at that time in Kilsyth. And then I worked my way up to become general manager of that shelter.
Okay, that's a lot in very few sentences. Do you mind if I just go back a bit?
Yeah.
Go back to actually to your first experience in the shelter itself. Was that very rewarding for you?
In the shelter, the first experience there, my instinct was to stay one day and never go back.
And what created that impression for you?
It was huge. That wasn't what bothered me. It was the fact that it was absolutely packed. There would have been at least 300 dogs there alone, not counting the cats and the wildlife and everything else. And the place was in a dreadful state of disrepair. There was, disease was rampant. There was a laissez-faire sort of attitude amongst the staff. You didn't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to work out that there was no disinfection program, there was no hygiene program with the staff. It just, from just what I saw very quickly, and having had that little apprenticeship in the kennels, the boarding kennels, I thought, oh no, this is terrible. I didn't even know it existed, but it turned out my boss at the kennels was a trustee on the board, and they couldn't get workers up there over the Christmas period, so she sent me. And initially it was just to clean kennels. But I thought after the first day, and actually Mum and Dad were staying with me at the time in Warrandyke, and I came home, and I walked in the door, I threw my bag on the table, went and had a shower, came out, and Mum said, how was it? And I said, I'm never going back to that place ever. I told her, I said, it's the most disgusting thing I've ever seen in my life. So we sat up that night, it was Christmas night, and Dad said, I can't imagine you turning your back on a challenge like that, and just left the room.
Oh, a smart man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And dangle with the carrot.
Yeah.
And then Mum said to me, well, what do you think you could do? And I said, I don't really think I can do anything except suggest we maybe start to use some bleach, change the water buckets, you know.
Really basic.
Yeah, basic things, baby steps.
Yeah.
So she said, well, you sleep on it. I'll wake you up in the morning in case you change your mind. Well, I went, Boxing Day, I went back. And I was there for 4.5 years.
Listen to older voices, reliving the spirit of Australia.
I'm uncertain which question to ask first, because so many came, just rushed into my mind as soon as you said you stayed there for 4.5 years. I think the logical first question is, what was it that made you go back the third day?
I think it was the going back to Mum and Dad. It was the installation at a very early age of right and wrong, and that animals are a perfect gift of love. Unconditional love. They've been put here by whatever to be respected and loved and cared for and not abused. And where possible, you help them because they can't speak.
So would it be right to say at least by day 3-4 you're beginning to believe that maybe you can make a difference?
Yeah, I did. I thought, well, I can only get shot down. But knowing that there was a board of trustees, I thought, well, even if I leave here after a week, I will write down what I've seen and hand it to them. Mm. And they can think about it, and maybe the next person who comes along can do these things.
But you didn't need to do that. So obviously the things you were saying or suggesting were taken up?
They were. Met with a lot of opposition. In fact, if you like, you've seen a lot of those sort of prison-type shows on TV. And there's a top dog and there are the little group that hang out with the top dog.
Yes.
And an outsider finds it very difficult to break into that inner circle. That's what the staff were like. They had been there since, goodness knows, since
they were really entrenched in there.
They were very entrenched. Yes. They were used to just doing a lot of nothing.
Yes.
They had a genuine love for animals, but they couldn't see what they were doing as wrong. Everything was impossible. No, you can't do that because.
Yep.
And the boss had been there for 25 years.
Oh, far too long.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this was just the way it was.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, well, it doesn't have to be this way.
So how did you go about affecting change? I don't mean you don't have to go into the nitty-gritty, but, I mean, what process did you use? How did you hang in?
Well, I had to get over the hurdle first of being totally put in Coventry.
Because oh, right.
One of the trustees had called a group meeting, I didn't know this, and told the staff that I was coming to work and told given the staff some background and said that I wasn't to be taken lightly because I had a university education.
Oh, great.
Which had nothing to do
with... No, of course it didn't. Dog food, that's right.
So, but see, they were all these... Well, they were kids, you know, from the age of 16, the eldest was probably 19.
Oh,
and they'd probably dropped out of school at the age of 14. Okay. They were very, very rough around the edges. Nice bunch of people, as it turned out. But I'd go in for morning tea and no one would speak. So I'd ask a question and they'd really, really completely ignore me. It was terrible. So I thought, I see, now why are they doing this? So once I found out why... Because one girl said one day she couldn't say the word university. She said, we're not interested in anybody coming here with a Vernon. She couldn't say it.
Couldn't even say the word, yeah. Yes.
I said, I'm not, it's got nothing to do with cleaning up after the animals, very sheepishly, I said. Because these were girls who would have given you a good hiding if they'd really wanted to.
Sure.
So what I did was I had a look in the storeroom one day. I asked them if they had any soap. And was laughed down. I said, not for the dogs, for us. We go around handling these dogs, a lot of which have got diseases and skin problems and all sorts of things, and then we eat our lunch.
Oh, great. Yeah.
I said, they could have ringworm or something. So I planted some seeds in their head, like, oh, I didn't think about that.
Yes.
Now, if it was going to affect them, they'd do something.
Kettle of fish, yes.
So they went to the boss, we need some soap. So the soap started to arrive in big gallon things. Then I suggested, well, since they were going into the kennels anyway, we get some stuff to wash the kennels out with, because what's the point in us soaping up? So gradually.
Gradually, yes.
Yeah, and it was an arduous task. But what brought it to a real head was the first day I had to be involved with the euthanasia, because we were a pound for five councils. Right. As well as animals being handed in by the public who'd found them or their own owners, we were a pound for five councils. So the trucks were coming twice a day, 5 days a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I guess not many animals are going to be found at home.
No, you can't. I mean, some of them were really, really, really old.
Yes.
I have a particular propensity and affection towards older animals. In fact, I started a program called Operation Granny Pet, where I would match an older animal with an older person, because I got sick and tired of seeing perfectly fantastic animals that were maybe, say, 7, 8, 9 years old.
Yes.
And they'd be the first ones to go.
Oh, how awful. Yeah.
Well, my first day, they threw me in the clinic. I had seen animals die, as I mentioned before, but I'd never seen someone deliberately killed something, especially
that
when it was
so traumatic,
healthy. It was shocking. And yeah. I decided that day I was never going back. So that we got it up on the table. I won't be too graphic. No. But it was a shocking thing to witness. Dog gets up wagging its tail, and lick, 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 you know, very happy little thing or big thing, as the case would be. Held on to because it was so happy. And the needle, and then it's lifeless.
Yes.
Just like that. I was shocked. I said a lot of very choice words about people and human beings. I was very emotional. I was extremely upset, crying and sobbing.
Oh, good reason.
I walked out.
Yeah.
And I happened to turn back just to shut the door and saw a couple of the staff smiling. And they thought, oh, that'll do it. She won't be able to handle that. She'll go.
Yes.
So I walked all the way out and I got right to the end of this corridor and stood there. And I thought, you walk out now, you won't go back. So I turned around and I went back. I thought, all right, if that's part of the
that
job.
That would have been so hard.
Well, it was, but it was, again, that strength of character had been instilled in me with Mum and Dad. I thought, it doesn't have to be like this. Yes, it's going to happen logistically because we didn't have the room.
Yes.
But it doesn't have to be like that all the time. No one knew this place was there apart from the locals. It needs publicity. People need to come and look, the pets. They need to know they can get really good animals, you know, companions and everything from this place. So I went back in. And that's probably on the list of hardest things to do. That rates is about the third.
Listen to older voices. Revisiting through recollections.
You mentioned that you were involved in a program matching older animals with older people. Was that as a result of this experience?
That was part of it, yes. Because you can get a dog that's, say, anything from five up. People aren't interested. They always want a puppy or something that looks like it's still just a bit puppy-ish.
Yes.
Which is often a very big mistake, and that's why the shelters end up with them. Buying from a shelter can... You know, you get something that's somebody else's problem because they've bought it for Christmas and had all the attention.
Yeah.
And then they go to work. Yeah. Of course, puppy's in the backyard, puppy digs up, puppy jumps the fence, puppy pulls the clothes off the line, puppy comes in with mud and jumps up because it's happy to see you, puppy doesn't get trained, puppy's a boomerang and comes back to from whence it was bought.
Yes.
And then somebody says, oh, but it jumps up and it... I often used to say to people, well, go to the toy shop and buy a stuffed toy. You won't have to feed it and it won't bark all day and it won't pull things off the line and it won't jump on
you. Yes, and it won't poo either.
It won't smell put it in your bed if you wanted to.
Yes, that's right. Yes. That's what you're looking for.
They'd be terribly offended. But that was what they were describing as. But these older animals had been trained, you know, that they...
And they also reach a placid stage of life, don't they? When they're just... A lot
of them had been fixed. They'd come from responsible homes where for some reason people couldn't keep them anymore.
Sure.
There were genuine reasons why people handed in their pets. Not always, but sometimes. So you had a history of an animal and someone had said, I'm buying it for my mother. Her dog died. How old's your mum? 78. I say, and you're buying a puppy.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
No.
You know, not because I'm not... saying that 78's a bad age, I think it's fantastic age to be. But...
The demands of a puppy.
Yes.
You can't be mad at that.
You can be a wonderful grandmother at 78, but you can hand the baby back.
That's right. That's right. This four-legged baby's not going to go anywhere.
This four-legged baby.
And it wants you to go with it.
Yes. And it will do things on a carpet. And it's time-consuming. Mm. And, you know, I started Operation Granny Pets. So anything that was over five... They had their little section. I worked out a way, if we quarantine the animals, vaccinate everything. And everyone said, oh, the cost, because we didn't have a big clinic and we have vets working for us, but only for a reduced pay, not for nothing. So I talked them down and got them to do cheap vaccinations because everything that came through the gate would be vaccinated.
Yes.
Regardless of whether it was put down or not. Stop disease from spreading.
Absolutely.
Just simple things like washing all the food bowls properly in a solution that kills parvovirus and different diseases so that the animals are eating off clean plates every day. Washing the kennels out with this special... Doing a course at Webster's to find out how disease is transmitted and educating the staff. I'd keep them behind for 10 minutes and give them some of my wage if we couldn't afford to pay it. Just to give them sheets of paper and sit up typing. It's a lot of hard work, but it was worth it.
Has that program finished or is it mutated into a different program or is it...
The animal aid, actually, I left. Unfortunately, when something's successful, there will always be somebody who wants a bite of the apple.
Yep, always.
Yes, and somebody came along, unfortunately, who... We were at our peak. We had a very good sponsor in Daryl Summers and his wife.
Right.
We were running successful fundraising activities. I got money from the government to refurbish the kennels.
Right.
And have the bricks rendered because they were porous and they were holding disease.
Yes.
So they were all sealed off. The concrete that was cracked was all replaced. So, you know, there's a lot of work went into it.
Yes.
But somebody wanted to bite the cherry.
Yes. See, something good and goes right.
Yeah.
Yes, I can run that. I can do that.
I can do that. Yeah. Yeah. So there was some political unrest and there was a lot that was wrong because she was on the board and board members aren't supposed to be staff members. No. So it turned out that she hoodwinked people and I thought, well, you can't fight City Hall. So I'd set it all up and done that. And I thought, well, it's time to move on. I didn't want to, but I thought, you know, I can only see this descending. She was doing things, I'd have my days off and would come in and send away the people who I'd ordered the chemicals from and buy cheaper chemicals.
Oh, okay.
Well, you get what you pay for.
Absolutely.
And animals started to get sick and I'd come back to work and I'd have to get the vet. We'd have to clean out the cattery, all the cats would have to go. And the breakdown in just simple, it only takes one person to do it.
Yes.
On next week's program, Robin finishes the stories of her animal welfare work, which are most inspiring, and she finishes off her life story with a truly remarkable tale of her meeting an angel. That's next week, part 3 of The Life and Times of Robin Yolton. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.